Okay, so now getting the practicalities out of the way, come back to the suttas. We're going to wrap up, going to come to the end of this sutta. And so this is all the most exciting parts on the path. All the awakening experiences, the deep samadhi and all of these kind of things are coming up. But before we come to that, we have to get the last bits of the defilements out of the way. That's always a problem on this path. So we're going to start with the final defilements, getting rid of those, and then we're going to move on just to have a look at the end point of the path. And that's kind of exciting, the end point of the path. It may not be kind of where everyone is at. Actually, very few people are there, but it's still nice to kind of see the goal, the map, including the goal, and where we're all heading. So we're going to go through those things. So we are looking, again, just to remind you, we're looking at the shorter sutta on the elephant's footprint. And this is the gradual training, taking you from the very beginning of the path all the way to the very end. And yesterday we had a look at this little passage that talks about how you find an empty lodging or a secluded lodging or a secluded resting place. And this is a sign that now we're getting into meditation proper. And it then goes on, and this is how it carries on after that. This is the next paragraph. So it goes on like this. It says, after the meal, they return from arms round. They sit down cross-legged with their body straight and establish mindfulness right there. Giving up desire for the world, they meditate with a heart rid of desire, cleansing the mind of desire. Giving up ill will and malevolence, they meditate with a mind rid of ill will, full of compassion for all living beings, cleansing the mind of ill will. Giving up dullness and drowsiness, they meditate with a mind rid of dullness and drowsiness, perceiving light, mindful and aware, cleansing the mind of dullness and drowsiness. Giving up restlessness and remorse, they meditate without restlessness, with a mind peaceful inside, cleansing the mind of restlessness and remorse. Giving up doubt, they meditate having gone beyond doubt, not undecided about skillful qualities, cleansing the mind of doubt. So this is obviously the five hindrances. For those of you who've been around for a while, you recognize those straight away. And these are like the refined defilements of the mind that we're talking about here. So you can see how we have progressed through this sequence. We started off by just the ordinary conduct by body and speech. And then we went into the contentment and the sense restraint, then the full awareness. So it's like it's a gradual cleansing of all the, basically of the mind, getting rid of defilements. But you will notice there's a particular sequence here, starting with the coarser things, going to the intermediate, and now we're coming to the very refined things. So the five hindrances are really a way of looking at the refined defilements of the mind. But let's start at the beginning here. After the meal, after the return from arms round, that's when meditation happens. If you are a monastic, you sit down cross-legged with the body straight. This is a standard instructions you find in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. This is what you find always. And then you establish mindfulness right there. So this is, again, the idea of establishing mindfulness first. All of these things, they point to the idea of meditation practice. It's not obvious what you're supposed to do. It says that you give up desire for the world. It doesn't say how you give it up. It doesn't give any context for abandoning these defilements. We have been abandoning defilements all the way through. So what's special about this? What is special about this is what happens during meditation practice. This is all the markers are there for meditation practice. And now using the object of meditation, you then abandon the final defilements of the mind. So what is that meditation practice? The main idea here is the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four establishings of mindfulness, which in turn then is explained as the mindfulness of breathing. So the way to overcome these defilements is basically to watch your breath. Yeah, that's really what it is about. So as when you come to this point, when it says, gives you this passage, it actually means doing your mindfulness meditation. So how does this overcome the defilements? Why does mindfulness of breathing overcome the defilements of the mind? And there is a number of reasons, number of ways this works. But one of the main ways is that when you focus on a particular object, and we saw this before when we looked at the five ways of overcoming unwholesome thoughts, if you take your attention away from those, from the desire, yeah, remember desire needs to be fed to continue. If you take away the cause for desire, the cause for ill will, neither desire nor ill will is able to continue because the cause is taken away. So by watching the breath, and instead of then delighting in the objects of those desires or looking at the object of the ill will, just by the very fact that you're watching the breath, observing the breath, means that you're not feeding the desire, feeding the ill will. And for that reason, it tends to die down. It's very simple, right? You just don't feed those things. You're staying with a different object, and that actually causes these things gradually to disappear. So this is part of how these defilements disappear. Another reason why they disappear, and this has to do with reflecting on your meditation. Yeah, the idea that you do your meditation, at the end of your meditation, you reflect back. And very often, what you will see is that maybe the mind was very busy, was thinking about things. It wasn't really willing to stay with the object. And if you are clear about what is going on, you will notice that it is these defilements that are blocking the progress of meditation. And if you're not clear about it, if it's hard to see, well, then you can take it from the Buddha that there is some attachment or holding on that is stopping you from going deeper. So then what you do is then you do some of the contemplations we have been talking about. How to overcome the more refined aspects of ill will, yeah, by thinking about the world, people in a new way. How to overcome the attachment to the five senses. Just a little bit of reflection on how the world is not maybe as interesting as it may seem. In fact, very often the world is basically out of control. We don't know what's going to happen with the world. And then you withdraw some interest from that world, and that very often allows the meditation to go deeper as a consequence. So these are the kind of things that you use as you go through this process of meditation right here. So this is kind of the idea, how meditation fits in with the abandoning of the five hindrances. And then gradually the mind becomes refined, and it goes through this process that we've been talking about all along here of finding gradually more peace and joy through the meditation practice. So let's look at these defilements in a little bit more detail to see what they are about. First of all, of course, there are five of these hindrances. Yeah, and as I think I mentioned before, of these five hindrances, the first two are by far the most important ones. And what you will find is that the last three, they are largely a result of the first two ones. Yeah, because if you have ill will, if you have desire, the mind will be restless. The mind will get tired because of all the doing in the mind and all the agitation that you have. So they tend to come about as a consequence of the first two. So the focus really for most people should be on the first two defilements, yeah, ill will and desires, and especially ill will because it is so kind of problematic. And by abandoning those, you are really abandoning all the five hindrances. So if you feel restlessness, if you feel drowsy, go back to the first two hindrances. That's where you usually find the solution to those problems. So ill will is the most significant one in terms of being the most destructive one, but in terms of being the most fundamental problem for meditation and the entire spiritual path, it is really the first one that is the most problematic one. The first one is like the root defilement of all defilements. That's actually not quite right. It is the root defilement in terms of achieving samadhi. in terms of actually making an end of all the problems and in terms of having the most profound insight, the root defilement is the sense of self. And it's these two things are really the things that we are looking to resolve on the spiritual path, is the kind of giving up the attachment to the five senses and then ultimately going beyond that and then giving up the illusion of a sense of self. These are the two things. If you look at the teachings and the suttas, like the three asavas, have you heard about the asavas? The kind of deep, asavas, like the kind of the very root defilements on the path. They're often called, translated as corruption, sometimes as taints, sometimes as various corruptions, I think, is quite a good translation. And these are often considered the root problems in the meditation practice. So when you become an enlightened one, when you reach the final stage of the path, the things that you actually abandon at that point are these asavas. And there are three here. It is the kama asava, which is the defilement or the corruption of the sensory world. And then there is the bhava asava, which is the corruption of existence, which has to do with the sense of self. And then there's the avijja asava, which is the corruption of ignorance or illusion or delusion at the very end of the path. So these are the three root defilements. And that's quite interesting, because of these three, there is karma, which is the sensory world. Then there is bhava, which has to do with the sense of self. And avijja is really just a summary of all of these defilements anyway. It doesn't really add all that much to it. So there's two main defilements there. Sensory world and the sense of self, the attachment to existence itself. And of those two, the preliminary one is the attachment to the sensory world, right? That's exactly what we're talking about now. And then down the track, after you have some success in samadhi, etc., then you deal with the idea of existence or the idea of I am, that kind of delusion. So this is a really big area. This is a really kind of the main problem on the spiritual path. The fact that we are so immersed, so attached, so utterly committed to the five sense world, it is very hard to get rid of this particular attachment. And that is why I spend quite a bit of time looking at those various similes and etc., because it allows us to move from a more coarse kind of existence to a more refined reality, which is the reality of the mind, where all of these kind of positive things start to emerge. So this is really kind of the big problem on the Buddhist path. So it is worthwhile reflecting on, worthwhile kind of getting used to these ideas and gradually kind of moving in a different direction. But remember, these are reflections to be done. These are not things that you can force. You can't really make them happen. So you have to allow the mind gradually to change its kind of interest in the world, its emphasis on what actually it takes to be significant and important. And as you do that, the path kind of goes by itself. It kind of happens by itself. And this is the ideal way of practicing the spiritual path, not by force, not by trying too hard, but allowing the whole ship, the whole super tanker, to kind of gradually take a different direction. The super tanker is the habits of the mind. They go forward with a massive momentum, and it's very hard to change this super tanker habits of ours. Takes a long time. If you are a super tanker going full speed ahead, it takes miles and miles and miles for that super tanker to change direction. So this is what we are looking at here. Now, one of the difficult things about the desire for the world, why this is so hard to give up, is because when the mind becomes very peaceful and quiet, actually what we are giving up is we're not just giving up the desires for all the objects in that world, but we're giving up the very idea of experiencing that world. The kind of the giving up of the idea of seeing altogether. So it's like your sight turns off, your hearing turns off. And that is why it is so hard to give up, because you actually, basically, you're saying, I don't care about these things anymore. They don't really matter to me. You're going into a very different place. And that is why it is difficult. But of course, it is worthwhile. And of course, you're giving it up. But it's only temporary anyway. It comes back again. But it feels like you're kind of doing a permanent elimination of the five senses. So this is why it is difficult. So You give up desire for the world. The world here is the world of the five senses. You meditate with a heart rid of desire, cleansing the mind of desire. Kama, kama chanda. Giving up ill will and malevolence, you meditate with a mind rid of ill will, full of compassion for living beings, cleansing the mind of ill will. So again, it's this idea, not just kind of being rid of ill will, but having the opposite idea in your mind, yeah? A mind which is very positive, a mind which is leaning in the right direction, isn't just neutral. It will often have these positive feelings coming along with that mind. And so you should be able to see that in your meditation, when your mind actually has these joyful, powerful, positive qualities. That's when you know you're on the right track. Giving up dullness and drowsiness. Sometimes as your mind starts to become very peaceful and still, you're getting a lot of joy and things arising in the mind, but still it's not fully bright yet. These defilements can be incredibly refined defilements. It may feel like you are the most awake that you have ever been in your life. Everything is kind of beautiful and powerful and bright and all of these kind of things. And still, it is not as bright as it actually you want it to be. Yeah, the degree of brightness we're talking about now is a very high degrees of brightness. And so when we talk about dullness, we're not talking about ordinary dullness. We just talk about the brightness hasn't been turned up to the maximum limit yet. That's actually what it means. So how do we do that? Well, you do that by just staying, being still, by allowing the process to happen, by focusing on the joy, the happiness of the experience. If the nimitta, the samadhi nimitta, the kind of lights in the mind, when they kind of appear, you just stay with them, you enjoy them, and you allow the experience to brighten up. And in this way, the drowsiness gradually fades away. So these are very... At this point in the meditation, it started to get extremely interesting. So you are perceiving light. Yeah, the mind is aloka sanya. It's like brightness or light in the mind. Not really light, but more like, like a general kind of brightness, not a specific light, if you like. Cleansing the mind of dullness and drowsiness. You give up restlessness and remorse. Remorse here, the idea of remorse is kukkucha, has again a very wide application. Of course, at this point, you don't think, oh, I shouldn't have done this, I shouldn't have done that. This is way, way behind you already, because there's no way you can have any meditation if you think like that. But here, it is more like the residue that remorse can leave in the mind. And the residue that remorse leaves in the mind is often a kind of, the mind is not fully bright, it is not fully happy. Yeah, it is like the nimitta, if you see a nimitta at this point, like a bright light in the mind, the light is not fully bright yet. That because the remorse dulls the mind. And sometimes you can see that in your meditation. You maybe have done something that you're not fully proud of, maybe even had a thought that wasn't kind, and that will actually dull the mind if these things happen. And this is why the idea of ethics is so important, and why it is such a profound thing. And you need to bring it into all areas of your life because it dulls the mind and it kind of makes it restless. Here it also makes it restless. It doesn't want to be still because it cannot really enjoy that experience fully. So you can see it's like it dirties the mind in a sense if you don't live fully, purely. So the more purity you have, the more pure that mental state is going to be. So remorse here is a very kind of subtle quality. It doesn't just mean the kind of the verbalization of being not satisfied with yourself. And again, restlessness here, also very, very subtle. The deeper you go in your meditation, the more kind of refined this restlessness is. And restlessness here will mean, for example, when you're staying with your breath or you're staying with the nimitta, you're staying with the bright light, and just a tiny movement in the mind. If the mind isn't absolutely still, there is a degree of restlessness there. This is nothing to do with ordinary restlessness, right? This is kind of very refined aspects of the mind. And the idea here is that to attain samadhi, which is absolute stillness of the mind is absolutely still. There's no movement at all. It is absolutely bright. There is no dullness of any kind there. So we are talking about, this is what I mean, it's very impossible to know what these defilements actually mean until you achieve a state of samadhi. It is only when you get to a jhana, when you come out of the water of the five hindrances, this is one of the things you leave behind, that you can understand what these things are. Because they are not dullness in any ordinary sense of the word. These are very deep, refined aspects of these hindrances. So you give these things up, you meditate without restlessness, your mind is peaceful inside, cleansing the mind of restlessness and remorse. You give up doubt, you meditate having gone beyond doubt, not undecided about skillful qualities, cleansing the mind of doubt. And doubt here, vichikicca, means doubt about what is wholesome in the mind, what is not wholesome in the mind. And this is one of those strange things as you do your meditation and you feel quite pure. Yeah, you're sitting there meditating, the mind doesn't seem to be any hindrances in the mind. There's no ill will, there's no desires, you're just peaceful and nice. Why doesn't it go any further? And you don't know what the problem is. Yeah, you have doubt. If someone asks you what is the problem, you say, I have no idea what this guy, I don't really know. It's a kind of doubt about actually what is going on in the mind, not understanding what you have to do to move on, because these are very refined things. And then as you move on, and maybe occasionally you have a little bit of a breakthrough, you go a bit further. And once you have that breakthrough, you look back, then you start to understand what the problem is. The doubt about what was the problem is kind of gone. So once you come to the jhana states and all the defilements are gone, only then do you go completely beyond doubt, because then you know what these defilements are. So this is why you have to go beyond that uncertainty about what is really skillful and what is unskillful to attain the jhanas. Now you understand what these things are. So this is the idea of vichikicca. It's a very specific kind of doubt. It refers to what are skillful and unskillful qualities of the mind. So these are the five hindrances for you. In brief, yeah, these are very, these are things that we probably could have talked a lot about, but this gives you kind of a rough summary of what they are all about. So let's just take a short meditation break, just to, Okay, all right. So any comments or questions about this? Yes, please.
Well, first of all, thank you. This is like making it more clear to me, like the differences between like the idea of clear comprehension versus like mindfulness.
Yeah.
And because I've seen in some other Buddhist circles where they teach people, they ring a bell and they immediately say, follow your breath.
Yeah.
This is going to bring about mindfulness.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's a bad sign, isn't it? Yeah, okay, yeah.
So I just wonder if you could maybe slightly elaborate on the difference between this idea of situational awareness versus like sitting down and having mindfulness before you notice the breath.
Yeah, okay.
Because I feel like sometimes I get conflated into one.
Yeah. It does, and the reason for that is because in the Satipatthana Sutta, they have that clear comprehension of full awareness or situational awareness that's actually inside the Satipatthana Sutta. So it's taken to be a meditation kind of practice, yeah, it's part of meditation practice, but actually it doesn't really belong in the Satipatthana Sutta. And you can see here it comes before the meditation, right? It's prior to meditation. The idea of full awareness or situational awareness is really about how we live our ordinary lives, how we go about things, and it's not really meditation proper. And I think it's important to just make that distinction. Yeah, this idea that doing meditation during daily life, well, actually, the suttas don't really talk about it in that way. Yeah, you don't do meditation daily life. You go to work, you wash the dishes, you do the vacuuming. It's not called meditation practice. It's called vacuuming. It's called And this kind of, you know, and I think that distinction actually matters. Yes, so what do you do then when you're vacuuming? Well, what you're doing is that, yes, of course, you try to be mindful because you want to do the right thing. You want to vacuum with a sense of, you know, in the right way. You do it as an act of service for your family or for whatever. And so you do it with the right attitude. So in that sense, you have mindfulness. But you don't really conflate it with meditation practice, which happens when you sit down, you watch the breath, and these kind of things. So that is the full awareness, you know, when you all the things that you do during your daily life, that is really where that is about. And so this is why I prefer to think about Satipatthana practice really just as breath meditation. That's what I think of it as. Because that is what the Buddha says in the suttas. You fulfill Satipatthana by watching the breath. You don't need anything else. Yeah, that is really the final kind of the practice that kind of it boils down to, really. Yeah. And that kind of simplifies things a lot, in my opinion. Yeah. So is that what you're asking about? Or?
I think I just wanted to hear you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, good. And this is one of the kind of great studies that my good friend Bhante Sujato did. He did a study called The History of Mindfulness, which is available online. I'm not sure if I would recommend it to people because it's very technical and very kind of quite difficult to read for many. I really enjoy reading it, but I mean, I'm kind of a specialist, you know, in the area. But he does a very interesting study of the Satipatthana Sutta, where he looks at the various versions of it. Have you read it, Adam? Yeah, you have read it. Okay, so yeah, that's good. No, I'm really glad that there are some people that are really into these things, you know. And he makes the argument there that if you look at the various versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, and you look at what they have in common, actually, it is not that much, and it seems to have been a sutta that has been added to over time and over history. And he argues it's one of the suttas that have been added the most to of all the suttas, which is remarkable when you think about it, because Satipatthana Sutta is taken very often in meditation circles to be the meditation sutta, the most important one. But actually, probably, it is the one that has been the most added to, so that's actually a very problematic statement to say it is the most important one. So you need to kind of come back to the bare bones of what it really is about, and it really is about meditation, watching the breath, that sort of thing. Yeah. And many of these other things are actually preliminary things that we do on the path to clear the mind, make it ready for that meditation practice. Yeah. Excellent. Yes, please, at the back there.
We've talked over the days, like dhyana practice and these refined states of mind have come up quite a bit. And
yeah.
It seems like people are quite interested in
Of course they are. Yeah, 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 absolutely.
They
yeah.
They are intriguing, but my sense is like, actually the question is, to what degree were these teachings on meditation directed to the lay community? It seems like to develop these states of mind, you'd have to be quite dedicated to the practice, so it seems like they might be focused on the
It's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a very kind of valid question, important question. And I would say that in ordinary life, when you go back to your kind of whatever you're doing in household life, and if you have an ordinary kind of layperson's life, busy with work, with family, and all those kind of things, you should not expect this kind of meditation. Yeah, go back in the evening, meditate, and expect bliss and joy? Probably not. If you can use meditation just to relax, just to bring about a little bit more well-being, yeah, that is actually good enough for, I think, ordinary life. But even for lay people, when you go on a retreat, when you withdraw from that world, you can sometimes achieve these kind of things. And I have known lots of lay people in my life, I mean really many, who actually achieve very beautiful states of meditation. I haven't spoken that much to all of you here, but there are probably people here today or during this retreat, which has been quite heavy on teaching, who probably have really had some nice meditation experiences. And so when you go on retreat, then all the things that you have done during your ordinary life, all the service you have been doing, the kindness you have been doing, the purification of your mind, it all comes together because you are withdrawing from that world, and then you start to see the results. So that's why I like to teach it, because it is a carrot, obviously, but it also is achievable for people on retreats. There is a sutta where the Anathapindika, who was one of the Buddha's main supporters at that time, he's the one who gave the monastery right in Savatthi, and the Buddha tells him, you know, even you as a layperson, you should sometimes you should seek seclusion, and you should seek that joy and happiness which is apart from the sensual pleasures. So it's a specific teaching to lay people as well. So yes, you have a point, but I would say that it's important to know that these things are available, right? And that they can be achieved by lay people. And just the idea that these things exist to me is just incredibly inspiring. Are these things really possible? It's like, wow, if these things are possible, I know what I'm kind of going to, what is important in my life and what I'm really going to focus on, what I'm going to prioritize. And this is kind of part of this whole marketing ploy from the Buddha's point of view. So thank you. Yeah. Anyone else like to say anything? Yeah. Yes, please.
Sort of related to that question, I'm just wondering if you think there's value in like a weekend self-retreat kind of thing to just strengthen the practice a bit if you can.
Try it out. See what happens. Yeah. There are people who get very good meditation when they're practicing by themselves. So it depends on the personality. Try it out. See how it goes for you. If you find value in it, do it. If you don't find any value in it, don't do it. Yeah. Please.
Yeah, I was wondering, when I do my meditations, I feel like, so I understand that we should step out of the way and just watch the nature of the breath. And it's our interference that kind of gets in the way. But at the same time, I have a hard time, with the inner commentator,
calm the commentator down. It is really about observing the breath, right? And if you really observe the breath, the commentator doesn't really get any room to comment after a while. So there comes a point when you become so, when that meditation really starts to work on the breath, and the commentator kind of gets banished because basically the breath becomes so prominent that there is no room for that commentary anymore. So don't worry too much about it. Don't try too hard to get rid of it. The very trying to get rid of it often creates more commentary. So just yeah, don't just observe the commentator. Oh, just observe the commentator, and then as you observe it, because the thing is that the thoughts can't really coexist with observation. And this is kind of the weird thing. So you just by standing back and observing the mind making commentaries, actually that already destroys the comments to a very large extent. And this was one of those four ways that we saw before in the Sutta on calming the thoughts, right? That they are just watching the thoughts. Actually, they calm down. You know, why am I walking fast? Let me walk slowly. Let me stand. Let me sit. Let me lie down. Yeah. So try just to observe. Don't interfere. Don't even interfere with the interference. So when your mind interferes, allow it to interfere and just observe the interference happening. Yeah, and then gradually it will come down. Yeah. All right. Yes, please, sir. Yeah.
Because I grew up with Zen, being the cultural milieu I was in. Mahayana Buddhism, and for me, when I finally encountered Theravada, it was a relief not to have a bodhisattva vow. I realized it affected my meditation so much.
Okay. I really. That's interesting.
You know,
Yeah. That's interesting. I never heard this before. This is the first time someone tells me this. This is fascinating.
I grew up Catholic, and everything was, I had to take care of everyone and serve everyone else. You know, it was just so much part of the conditioning.
Yeah.
That just added more, like, oh,
I see. Yeah. I see. Okay. I understand. Yeah. Yeah, to me, it's just, I can't really comment exactly on that because I don't even know much about the Bodhisattva vows. I never really studied much Mahayana Buddhism. But to me, it's just that the Buddha didn't teach the Bodhisattva vows. This is a kind of a later development in Buddhism. Yeah, and so, they don't. No, they don't tell you that because they consider it on the par with the teaching of the Buddha. They know it is well known in Mahayana circles that are well studied. It is well known that the early suttas is one thing and Mahayana teaching is later. It's just that they accept that on equal footing as the early teachings. Whereas for me, that is not entirely acceptable because the Buddha is the starting point of this whole thing, because the Buddha is a starting point, and his insights are the foundation for everything. That is what is also the core, what Buddhism really is about. So I don't fully accept that explanation. I'm not saying there's no value in those things. I'm just saying it cannot be on the same footing as the word of the Buddha. So for that reason, you kind of, you just put it to one side then, and then that's fine. So good. I'm glad you have kind of emerged from that problem and kind of found your way through. So that's great. Can I do you mind if I ask you your name, or do you prefer
Rebecca
not to?
Rebecca.
You're also Rebecca. Yes. So we have two Rebeccas here. Okay. So that. Okay. Okay. Very good. Okay. Great. Yeah. Sure. Good. Any more comments on that? Yeah, please, David. Yeah.
Just a quick one. If we're meditating and some of these hindrances start to bubble up, is it the case that everything that happened earlier, that's the result and playing out? And so, in other words, in the meditation, can we help calm down and resolve those defilements, or does the work have to be done beforehand?
I would say both. Yeah, both things. So if you have a lot of defilements beforehand, it's probably a good idea to kind of allow them to calm down before you even try to meditate, because it's going to be very difficult to focus on anything or, to find any peace or whatever. So at the beginning of your meditation, ask yourself if you feel ready to meditate. Don't just sit down regardless. Ask yourself, what is the state of your mind? And if you find that your mind is too restless or too agitated because of whatever desires or ill will or whatever, then do something else first of all. Find some inspiration by reading something nice, put on some delightful music, whatever it is, some chanting even. If you'd like that, have a cup of tea, do some walking meditation if you can, whatever it takes to kind of get the mind ready, and then sit down afterwards. And sometimes that can happen very quickly. It may only take 10 minutes or something. Other times it may never happen at all. Yeah, you never get ready. And this is kind of the way things are. But then you will find that even during meditation, these defilements can recur, right? And so then you use those five methods we were talking about before. Go back to those five methods and start from the top. And then find out roughly which method is going to work for you. And the more proficient you are in dealing with the mind, the higher up the list you go. And the ideal is to go to the very first one, right? So you see a little bit of ill will arising and you know straight away exactly what is the counter measure, and bang, the ill will is gone. That is the ideal way. So a bit of both. And I think you, hopefully be on the right track. Okay, so let's. We only have an hour left. Time goes very fast, so we haven't got much more to do, so that's good. So we can just enjoy the kind of profound aspects of the path. So now we come to the jhana states. So it carries on. They give up these five hindrances, corruptions of the heart that weaken wisdom. And quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, they enter and remain in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, while placing the mind and keeping it connected. I'll talk about this in a second. This Brahmin is called a footprint of the Buddha, and also used by the Buddha and marked by the Buddha. But a noble disciple wouldn't yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One, the Buddha, is a fully awakened Buddha. The teaching is well explained. The Sangha is practicing well. So here we have the first jhana. So first of all, after you give up these five hindrances, corruptions of the heart, ceto upakilesa. Upakilesa is what is called a corruption here. It is really kind of a defilement of the heart or corruption of the heart that weaken wisdom. This is what is it? Panya dubala karana or something like that. So this is kind of interesting, right? Whenever you have the defilements in the mind, your mind doesn't really have the wisdom is weak. Wisdom to me, I don't know about you, but wisdom to me is like this beautiful quality. What does it mean to be wise? Well, what it means to be wise is to understand how we work as human beings. It means having the ability to navigate the world, navigate our relationships, think about things in the right way, understanding what leads to happiness and suffering, how to deal with other people. It has to do with psychological insight, especially the deep psychological insight. So wisdom is this beautiful quality that always moves us towards happiness and away from suffering. So anything that weakens wisdom is bad, right? It's terrible. So these five hindrances, they are bad news because they basically destroy your ability to find happiness. So that is why this is so the more you think about them, the more you kind of reject these things, and the more you understand why it is important to reject them, the more it helps you to establish that mindfulness at the back of your mind that always guides you in the right way, because you understand the incredibly detrimental effect of these qualities. So, then, quite secluded from sensual pleasures. Again, this should really be quite secluded from the five senses. The Pali here is viviceva kamehi. Kamehi is a plural word, and when the kama, which is here often translated as desire, it is used in the plural, it always is a reference to the five senses. So it means fully secluded. Viviceva, eva is like fully, it's an intensifier, fully secluded, fully separated from, this verb vivicha viveka means separation from. You're fully separated from the five senses. So this is the first part. The second part is fully separated, or separated from unskillful qualities. Well, these are precisely the five hindrances we have looked at. So these are then the two main kind of viewpoints, or two main aspects through which you know that you have attained a jhana experience. The senses are gone and the five hindrances are completely gone. mind is utterly pure and clear and is kind of completely immersed, completely within itself. There's no kind of extension into the world. You find similes for the jhanas in some places. You find a simile of the turtle that kind of pulls in all, all his limbs into his shell. Yeah, and when the turtle kind of pulls its limbs into a shell, the head and four limbs, in the same way, a jhana state is about like pulling the limbs into your shell. Yeah, five limbs, yeah, two front legs, two back legs, and the head. Five limbs, five senses. They're all withdrawn within yourself. They don't extend into the world anymore. It's kind of these similes make it fairly clear what is going on. So this is what happens, and then you enter and remain in the first absorption. Yeah, it is a state that you enter a state. It's a very, very kind of, it is a separate thing. There's a sense of moving from one thing to something else, like you're entering a different world, right? This is what this is like. It is not like just a clear continuation from one thing to another one. There's a sense of a point at which you... there's like a major change or shift in your perception that you go through. It's not just a gradual continuation, but a kind of cut-off point where you enter something else. This is kind of what these absorptions are like. And then you experience, what do you experience? Well, you experience the rapture and bliss born of seclusion. These are the vivekaja, pitisukha. Pitisukha, rapture and bliss, and vivekaja. And so the point here is that this is a very particular kind of rapture and bliss. It is not just any kind of rapture and bliss, but it's a very specific kind. And we talked before many times already about this sequence, right, where you go from sila to non-regret, from non-regret to pamuja, which is glada pamuja, to piti, which is rapture piti, to pasadi, which is tranquility to sukha, which is then the bliss you see here. And then from that bliss, you get to samadhi. So all that bliss, building up, until you get to a very specific kind of bliss and happiness, which is the vivekaja pitisukha, that is the bliss of the first jhana. So it is a very profound bliss. Yeah, it is not just ordinary bliss. There's a lot of misunderstanding about what these deep jhana states actually are. But if you start to see how the build-up is mentioned in the suttas, how you build up through the various stages, it is very obvious that here we are dealing with something very profound, something very evolved. And it's not just any kind of joy or happiness in the path. So it is these things are really otherworldly. You enter a different reality. And when you enter that different reality, you can expect to experience, have experiences that actually are otherworldly. You're coming to the end of the world, the lokanta. And this is why this is called the footsteps of the Buddha, right? If you are in the footsteps of the Buddha, is it going to be an ordinary experience? Well, if we assume that the Buddha had a very profound insight into the nature of reality, it makes sense to think that his experiences are going to be very different from ordinary experiences. Otherwise, they don't really have much value. They have to be something different. Otherwise, you cannot really come out and claim awakening. You're claiming an insight into something that changes your entire perception of the world. Yeah, non-self, seeing the five khandhas as dukkha, all of these kind of things. It is a shift, entire, complete shift, a revolution in your understanding of everything. So these things are almost bound to be very profound. That's why they're called uttarimanusadhammas. Yeah, the qualities beyond human beings. Because at this point, you stop being a human being. Right? In a sense, you do, because you enter a state where your humanity has completely disappeared. This is why, in a sense, is the Buddha male or female? Actually, the Buddha has gone way beyond being male or female. Is the Buddha Asian or Western or African or anything else? Gone beyond all of those identities. Is the Buddha from this culture or that culture? Is the Buddha... So this is kind of the beauty of these things, because at this point, you go beyond your humanity and we kind of enter a reality which is the same for every one of us. And that's kind of nice. So the Buddha, anyone who was awakened, has gone beyond these limitations that kind of create so much divisions in our society. So these are very profound states. So if this is the case, well, what is this idea of placing the mind and keeping it connected? What is that all about? And what that is about this translation of the two words that are found here, which are vitakka, vichara. And now these words, someone mentioned that earlier on this retreat, and now we can maybe talk a little bit about it. Vitakka and vichara are often translated as thinking in the suttas, thoughts and examination or something like that. And if you translate these things as thoughts and examination in the context of the first jhana, actually you're missing the idea of what they really are referring to. So remember that the idea of thought, yeah, that will really depend on the, what does it actually mean to think something? Yeah, yeah, and you can imagine that they are very refined thoughts, they are very coarse thoughts. Now here we are talking about the most refined thoughts possible. Why? Well, because in the second jhana, vitakka, vichara comes to a complete stop. So the first jhana must be the most refined thought that is possible to have. So what does that mean? Well, if you take thinking and you make it more and more refined, yeah, well, it kind of makes sense that the very last vestige of thinking in the mind is just a very slight movement of the mind. Yeah, because thinking is a movement of the mind. Verbalization is a kind of continuous change of perception, a continuous change in the mind. And so the final kind of idea of thinking really is just this basic idea of movement in the mind. That makes very good sense when you start to think about it. So if you translate here these words as thinking, well, you're kind of missing the point. Yeah, you won't actually understand what is going on. And that is why Bhante Sujato translated it as placing the mind and keeping it connected. And what this is referring to is this final movement of the mind onto the bliss and then withdrawing a bit from the bliss and then moving onto the bliss. Yeah, it's like this wobble of the mind. That's kind of the Ajahn Brahm translation of this. The mind is wobbling a little bit. And that is really the way of thinking about this. And it's actually very important because a lot of people in the world translate these things as thinking and pondering. Pondering, that's kind of terrible. Pondering is like deep thinking, right? It's like really pondering. That really misses the point. So this is getting close to what we're talking about. First jhana, super duper refined. It is called the footprint of the Buddha and used by the Buddha. In other words, the Buddha uses this in his quest for awakening, marked by the Buddha. It is marked in the sense that when the Buddha kind of passes through it, when you get there, you can see this is like a mark of the Buddha. The Buddha would have also passed through this territory here. Yeah, so in other words, you are starting to realize that you are very close to awakening. You're realizing that the only path to awakening must happen through these states. Yeah, that's what you're starting to realize. They are so profound, so deep, that you know you're not in the presence of awakening itself. That is how you can know that these things are marked by the Buddha. The footstep of the Buddha. The Buddha was here. Yeah, you can see the footprint of the Buddha. What does the footprint of the Buddha look like? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, etc., etc. So, these things are, so this is why this is so fascinating. So you realize it is marked by the Buddha, but you haven't yet seen the Buddha fully. That's why you don't come to the conclusion that the Buddha is fully awakened. The teaching is well explained, the Sangha is practicing well, because you haven't yet come to the very end of the path itself. There still is a bit further to go. So first jhana, so you think that you have just experienced the most amazing, remarkable, profound thing that is possible to experience. And then lo and behold, you go even deeper afterwards. Well, this is the next one here. Furthermore, as the placing of the mind and keeping it connected is stilled, a mendicant enters and remains in the second absorption. Yeah, and then it describes the second absorption. I'm not going to pass over it now. I'm not going to go into all the details. And then you go to the third absorption, and you go to the fourth absorption. Yeah, each one more amazing than the previous one. Each one more profound. Each one more happy than the previous one. And so this is kind of how this path, why this path is so extraordinary and why it is so utterly interesting. Yeah? And then when you come out of the fourth absorption, this is where the mind reaches its pinnacle of mindfulness and equanimity. And equanimity is this ability just to observe, just to be with things. Yeah, and this is where it becomes imperturbable. The mind cannot be moved at all anymore. And this is then when the mind is ready for the really profound insights. So this is where you recollect your past lives. Wouldn't that be great? Do you want to recollect your past lives? I think it's probably quite scary. Yeah, remember, it is scary to remember your past lives. It sounds like a cool thing to do, but actually when you see it, it's probably very, very off-putting and actually very, wow, this is what's happening. And this is why the Buddha, during his awakening experience, he remembers his past life, first of all, because when you remember your past lives, what you are actually seeing is suffering. Yeah, you're seeing dukkha. And this is why the Buddha had to see this before he could then move on to kind of the full awakening experience. It's a very kind of scary, and that's why you have to have the fourth jhana to be ready for that, because the mind has to be incredibly stable to be able to have a recollection of the past life. So what does it mean to recall your past life? Well, what it means is that it's a very kind of systematic thing. So you remember a past life, you remember how you lived during that life, you remember the kind of happiness and suffering you have, you remember your many details of that life, and then you see how that life then goes on to the next life, right? How there is a causality there, one thing leading to the next one. Then you live in that next life, and you have a similar experience of that life that comes afterwards. And these are not memories in the ordinary sense of memories. This is like a reliving of these things. They are far more powerful than memories. It's like you are there and you can see how you are moving on, from one thing to another one, causally going on. And then eventually you can see how you go from that last life into this particular existence. So you see the whole causal sequence. And because you can see the causality and you can see how it leads up to the present life, you don't have much doubt anymore that this is what's going on. It is very obvious that these are real past life experiences. You see the whole thing happening in this way. This is how you know it is a real past life experience. Then you have the knowledge of the death and rebirth of sentient beings. You can see how living beings move from one life to the next one. You can see how some, expanded this in full, but anyway, never mind. So you can see how beings actually pass on in accordance to their actions. And it says there how beings having wrong view, and not just having wrong view, but acting according to their wrong view, that leads to a bad rebirth. And that's, I think, an important point. Sometimes people think that wrong view in itself leads to a bad rebirth. But actually, according to this, it's really only when you act it out that it is really a problem. Wrong view in its own right is not good, obviously. Actually, tends to have very bad consequences, but it's when you act it out that it really becomes bad. So you can see this kind of how this whole thing works just by observing other beings and also seeing it in your own life. So this is the idea, what is going on here. And then the very last thing that you see is that you see this is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. So the very last thing that you see here is the Four Noble Truths. Why do you see that? How can you see the Four Noble Truths? Well, what you actually see is you see non-self. This is the real insight that you have. Because what you do is that you are coming out of these jhana experiences, you are reviewing what happened in those jhana experiences, and what you see is you see the impermanence of all phenomena. And when you see the impermanence, the unreliability, the uncertainty of all phenomena, that there's no inherent essence to those phenomena, what you see is non-self. And suddenly you make that breakthrough. So far, when you get to the jhana states, you have already given up a lot of the idea. You already see a lot of impermanence already, because all those things that are not part of the jhana experience well, they are impermanent, right? Yeah, all those things that you have given up, five senses, the body, the five hindrances, the will, so much of your perceptions and feelings, all of that has been left behind. And because it has been left behind, and you are kind of still here in the first jhana, that is all impermanent. Also, you know, it's all dukkha, because without it, you are far better off. So as you go through this process of samatha and vipassana, as you enter the deep states of jhana, actually, there's an enormous amount of information that comes with that. There's the information about the how these things are impermanent and how they're changing. It's really the five khandhas that you are seeing in this way, yeah? Because everything in experience is just five khandhas. So as the deeper you go in the samatha, the more things you have left behind, because samatha, this experience are very narrow experiences, with all you really have is bliss, everything else is left behind. All the stuff that is left behind is impermanent, suffering, and because you can't access it, it is also non-self. And the only thing that you have left to contemplate is that jhana experience itself. Everything else is already, you have already sorted it out. And then you look at that jhana experience, and you realize that that jhana experience itself is conditioned. It happens when you practice in a certain way. When you guide your mind in a certain way, that's when you have these experiences. And then one day you realize even this is a condition, is unreliable, is uncertain. And that at that point, you have seen everything in the realm of the five khandhas, everything in the realm of experience as inherently without essence. And that is the insight into non-self. And when that happens, you no longer have any vested interest in existence. You no longer have any vested interest in these five khandhas. You no longer have any vested interest in your own mind. It's kind of strange, isn't it? How can you not have a vested interest in your own mind? Well, because it's not really your own mind anymore. Mm. It's just nature. It's just things unfolding, right? And you realize, actually, the whole thing was just suffering in the first place. Once the vested interest is taken out of it, only then can you see it neutrally for what it actually is. And once you can see it neutrally, actually then you are capable of seeing everything in experience as problematic. This is why you can then have this insight into suffering, fully seeing what's going on. And then you also, as part of this, you see the driving force behind this, how craving is a driving force that drives this process. That is also what you see. Why do you see that? Well, because you have seen because you see everything as suffering, for the first time in your life, craving is gone. Because you cannot crave for what is suffering, suffering comes to an end, then you also understand the nature of craving, because you emerge from craving for the very first time. So you understand the nature of craving, what that does, how it projects you into the future at all times. And then you know that the ending of craving is the ending of rebirth, is the ending of the perpetuation of this process. So you understand the third noble truth. And as part of all this whole experience, you understand the idea of purity, how that leads to insight. You have now seen the path in practice because you have been through the path yourself, so you also understand the path. This is in brief how you have this profound insight into the nature of reality at this particular point. Okay, let's just meditate on that for 5 minutes, see what it does. Okay. So let me just, before we take some more questions, let me just finish this thing off. Then we can discuss it a bit more detail. So so you have that insight, and then you understand rebirth is ended. The spiritual journey has been completed. What had to be done has been done. There is no return to any state of existence. This Brahmin is called a footprint of the Buddha. It is also used by the Buddha, marked by the Buddha. At this point, a noble disciple has come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is a fully awakened Buddha. The teaching is well explained. The Sangha is practicing well. And it is at this point that the simile of the elephant footprint has been completed in detail. So just to explain this to you, then we can have a bit of a discussion. When you are reached a full awakening, what do you understand? You understand that rebirth has come to an end. Yeah, there is no return to any state of existence. And you will note that this is actually the understanding of an arahant. And yes, the spiritual journey has been completed. What had to be done has been done. That doesn't really add all that much. Okay, you just know you have finished a job. But that finishing, what does it consist of? It consists of rebirth is ended. That's really what it consists of. Yeah, this is kind of the only thing that is really mentioned here. And so again, the whole idea of awakening in Buddhism, the whole idea of seeing things fully, of coming to the very end of the path, has to do with the ending of rebirth. Without the ending of rebirth, without the idea of rebirth, the whole Buddhist idea of awakening really falls apart. So it is absolutely fundamental to what we're talking about. And this is kind of the same, basically, throughout the sutta. This is always the insight of the arahant. They know that rebirth has come to an end. Why? Because they have destroyed the cause of rebirth. The cause of rebirth is craving. That is gone. And they understand the nature of the causality between craving and rebirth. So they know it's come to an end. Now, this is the real footprint of the Buddha. And that's why the disciple comes to the conclusion. Yeah, now you have seen what the Buddha has seen. So you know that his teachings, where they come from, and you can see the relationship between his teachings and obviously the insight itself. And then you come to the conclusion. The Buddha is fully awakened. The teaching is well expounded or explained, because everything now comes together. The Sangha is practicing well. The Sangha here referring to the noble Sangha, those who have insight into these teachings. It is practicing well. Why? Because it is following those teachings that are well explained. It is at this point that the simile of the elephant's footprint has been completed in all detail. So there you are. That is that sutta on the shorter simile of the elephant's footprint, and it goes now, that's all the way to the very end, with all the insights and all of those aspects also. So, what do you think? Yes, please, at the back there.
So where does stream entry?
Well, stream entry happens somewhere along here, right? And the reason why stream entry isn't really mentioned is because it can happen anywhere during the sequence. So very often it may happen after the first jhana or the second jhana or something like that, and it will happen as part of this thing here.
I have another question.
Please.
That sounds to me like it's depending on others.
Yeah, but the point here is not that the Sangha is practicing well. The point is that the noble Sangha is practicing well. So the reference here is not just to anyone in the Sangha. It's a specific reference to those people in the Sangha who are noble ones, who have that insight, who are stream enterers, in other words. They are practicing well because they know the teaching. Whether they want to or not, they're practicing well there. Yeah. So that's the thing there. It's kind of interesting about how this psychology works. Once you have internalized these teachings, it is like they become part of you. You are those teachings in a very real sense. What is a Buddha? Well, a Buddha is really someone who has made those teachings real. This is kind of the idea of realized. And the Buddha becomes almost like a physical or a human expression of the Dhamma, of these teachings. The Buddha is like a walking example of the Dhamma, right? That's kind of what he is. And so you internalize this teaching. They become basically your entire psychology, your psyche, your mental faculties become this kind of Dhamma experience. This is what you are. You are the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. You have this insight. This is what you carry with you all the time. So once you are a stream enterer, because this affects your psychology so deeply, you cannot avoid but practicing this path. Once you have seen that the coals are over here, and if you touch them, they're hot, no way you're going to touch them anymore. Why on earth would you, right? You know it's going to hurt. So you just withdraw from those things. If you know that being immoral is painful down the track for yourself, for others, for everyone, why on earth would you want to be immoral? You want to be kind at all times, because this has now been deeply kind of seen by you and understood by you. So it affects you in a very profound sense. So in this way, the Sangha has to practice the right way. There's no choice in the matter here. And that, of course, is to their benefit. Yes? Am I able to speak personal experience? Monastics don't talk from personal experience. And the reason is very simple, that first of all, there is actually a rule against speaking from personal experience. And the reason why there is that rule is because things become very dodgy when you start talking from personal experience. Because first of all, it's easy maybe to exaggerate. It's easy to become spiritually materialist. Everyone is talking about their experiences, and it's also very uncertain. Sometimes people think they have experience, and then they haven't actually got them, and then it doesn't really work. So it's much better for everyone to judge whether a teacher is worthy of confidence or not, just by looking at their conduct and looking at from the outside. If I tell you that I have attained something or whatever, or if anyone tells you that, should you just believe that? It is very dangerous to believe those things, because it is just a subjective thing from that person. It could be completely wrong. So far better for you to kind of observe. And if you see that someone is worthy of confidence because they have certain qualities, then place confidence there. Maybe not complete confidence, but at least some confidence. And that is the right way of approaching these things. Because it's very unreliable, people saying, I'm enlightened. You hear these things all the time. And what people mean by enlightenment is just so incredibly varied, right? Some people have a little bit of a nice experience and they think that's enlightenment. And it means nothing, right? So the whole thing is so delusive and so uncertain and so unreliable. So it's not really worthwhile going there. Please.
I want to follow up on that. So is that in regards just to meditation, personal experience, or is that in regard to, you can't talk about the first time you took 5 precepts, you can't talk about how the early teachings affected you, as a matter of all personal
experience? Right, okay, so that's a good point. So you can't talk about certain things that are considered the profound experiences on the path. Yeah, that's what you can't talk about. So you can't go around saying, I have, attained the jhana, or I'm a stream winner, or anything like that. That would be inappropriate. So that's where it comes to, yeah. So yes, good point. Yes, please. Okay, yeah. Yeah.
So you point out that the later hindrances are actually very refined, not the generic meaning that it seems to imply.
I mean, they can. They're not always refined. I mean, they can be very coarse. Yeah, they can be very strong in your mind. You can feel very drowsy. You can feel very restless. But normally, that when they are very coarse, it is usually comes from the first two hindrances. That's why they are very coarse. You have a lot of desire. You have a lot of ill will, and then this restlessness is a function of that. Yeah. So it is derived from that. But once the mind becomes very, very peaceful and still. Yeah, then often there is a remnant of hindrances that are very refined. And this is what I think it refers to in this particular context, because we're already dealing with meditation here at a fairly refined level. So I think this is kind of the main idea at this point. You notice on the early portions of the path, it talks about for example, with sense restraint, it only talks about two defilements, desire and aversion, right? These are the two defilements there. It doesn't really talk about anything else. Most of the path is actually concerned with those two defilements until you get to refined aspects of meditation practice. And that's where the five kind of hindrances are talked about. So it's only at this point that this becomes important. Earlier on, the ideas of restlessness and dullness are not really significant. What is important is the desire and the aversion.
There was a sutta where these hindrances are compared to like the water being polluted in a certain way.
Yeah.
But it just seems to me that somehow the hindrances are referred to in like their generic meaning according to that comparison.
I mean, you can use them in a broader context if you like, but even if they are refined, they are going to match those similes, right? They're still going to have that kind of effect on the mind, but just more refined effect on the mind. So you have, for example, the idea, one simile is how water is, if you're restless, the water is choppy, it's not still. And that, of course, there is a degree of choppiness, even though it is much less, even when you come to meditation practice. Or if you have ill will, it's like the water is boiling, right? And there's a degree to which that mind is restless or is agitated in the same way as water is boiling, even when it's very refined. So there's a little bit left of those things. There's also the coloring of the water, which is another similar, two different sets of similes for the five hindrances. So I would say, yes, you can expand it if you wish, but the way that the hindrances are used in the suttas, it is usually used for these very refined aspects of the mind. That's really what it is about, as far as I can tell anyway. Because this is why they come so close. They come at this point. They come after you're sitting in meditation, right? If you look at how they're placed there, it matches very well with the idea of meditation practice. All right. So we're coming very close to the end now. You know, this is your last chance to ask any kind of questions you may have, regardless of... please, Carol. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it just a flow, or must you take a deep breath or do something?
Usually it's a flow, It's not something that you do. So the question often is, well, how do you decide whether you go into the first jhana or the second jhana? And that will depend on the inclination of your mind as you enter the jhanas. So kind of the way that jhanas will happen is that you kind of enter the jhana, and it's kind of if the mind has a strong momentum of peace, or whatever you want to call it, will kind of quickly go through the first jhana and then they go into the second, for example. But if the momentum of peace is not so strong, they may stop in the first jhana. So that depends on the intention and the inclination of the mind as you enter these states, how deep you go. And it's not something that you can really do afterwards. You're kind of stuck in there. You are happily stuck, but you are stuck nevertheless. Please, Rebecca. Yeah.
I was just curious about Varuna. You wanted our contributions to go there. Where is it, and is there something that caused you to decide for the contributions to go to Karuna.
Actually, good point. Yeah, I should really say something about that, because I stayed there. When I was in the Bay Area, I stayed with them for 5 days. And we have a connection with them because one of the two bhikkhunis staying there, one is Venerable Santusika, the other one is Venerable Chidananda. And Venerable Chidananda has already stayed with us in Perth for 3 months for the Rains Retreat. And Venerable Santusika is coming now for the Rains Retreat this year. So we have a connection with them. And they have a very similar outlook on Buddhism to what we have. They're very interested in the suttas, in the word of the Buddha. And when I go there, I feel really at home because they have a very kind of similar approach to how to practice these teachings.
So that would be a good place maybe for a woman to go, or men and women?
Yeah, especially for women maybe, probably easier. So yeah, it's a good place to go. I mean, they're still in the startup phase, a bit small. It's not, they don't have kind of great facilities or anything.
They do retreats and,
They do teachings. I'm not sure whether they do retreats. Not sure, but you can stay there. That's kind of can become a little bit of a retreat, you know. But it's a very small, it's a very humble place. Yeah, there's nothing like our monastery in Perth. But because they were so kind to me, I thought I would do them a favor in return, and then say, okay, let the donations from this retreat go to them. And it also feels nice. Yeah, it feels kind of like a nice thing to do because it's sometimes when you. If you do something for kind of, and kind of the money comes back to the Buddha site, it's very close to where I'm doing. But when you give to something else, it has a kind of nice feeling to it. So, anyways, that's kind of what we, what I decided to do here. Yeah. Who's next? Yeah, Kyle, you want to go first? Yeah.
I'm really curious. If I were to shadow you on a typical day at your monastery, yeah. That you're teaching or leading retreat, or doing
Yeah.
As a life of Ajahn Brahmali, from wake up to sleep, what
okay.
I see.
You will get really disillusioned, right? You would really, that would be the end. You would never come back on a retreat again. You would see all the kind of things I get up to. So what would you see? You would see getting up in the morning, maybe 4:30 or something like that in the morning. Yeah, it varies a little bit depending on what I'm doing and things. And then you would see some meditation practice in the morning. And then you would see some, maybe having some breakfast, maybe not, depending on the day. Then probably some physical work. Typically we do some physical work. This is outside of the rains. During the rains, a bit different. And so you kind of get some exercise, which is good. And then in the afternoon, I often do some study. I do some translation work and that kind of thing. And then in the evening, some more meditation, etc. again. And then we go and listen to Ajahn Brahm giving a talk. Something like that, very boring. You get bored out of your mind if you saw what I was doing. Very uninteresting.
So I've heard a story of, I forget what monk it is, that he meditates for 14 hours a day, which seems a lot. Plus he does all this other stuff. But on average, and I know every monk is different. Mm.
It was very, very, very variable. You can't really say. There may be days you don't do any meditation at all, and there are other days you meditate all day. And it's just kind of very, very variable. Depends, because it's not about doing meditation all the time. The path has to be balanced to really give results. So if you don't balance the path, if you don't do things that support the meditation as well, often it doesn't actually get anywhere, unless you're already very profound. If you're really a long way on the path, then you can meditate 24/7. But for most monastics, I would say it's good to have a balance between, you know, with various kind of things. Good. Yes, please. Tusika.
Tusika. Going to be here
then. Okay, good. Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, thank you for that piece of information. Yeah. So, yes, please.
Are there monastics who never enter into jhana states?
Oh, yeah, I would probably say the majority never into jhana states because, monastics are like ordinary people. And it takes a long time, a lot of practice, gradually moving in that direction. So I would say the majority. But the more senior you are, the more likely it is that you will be there because you have practiced over a long period of time. So, yes, Carol.
I wanted to ask about
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay.
It's dark.
Yeah.
There's no light. There's no sound. The water is the same temperature as the air. So after a while, when you're meditating, you don't feel the water.
Yeah.
You just feel suspended. And there's nothing but your mind. And my mind goes quiet.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, is that almost what emptiness is like?
Yeah, emptiness is... It has different, you know, the meaning of emptiness is a bit contextual. So, for example, there's a couple of suttas that talk specifically about emptiness. There's the shorter sutta on emptiness and the longer sutta on emptiness, right? There's kind of very imaginative names for some of the suttas. What the shorter sutta on emptiness says is that's like, it's what they call a gradual entering into emptiness. So you start off when you come to a place like this, there's a degree of emptiness right here, because now your life is empty of your other life, yeah, of your work, of your family commitments, of the cities and whatever else. And you have kind of the perception of BCBS, right? It's a kind of simple perception compared to ordinary life. So that is emptiness to the extent that you have removed yourself from those things. And then the deeper your meditation go, the more emptiness there is, because you are giving up all of these things. And you're kind of down to the breath, you're down to the light in the mind, into the jhana state. So each one of those states are a degree of emptiness. And it actually is very useful to recognize that as you go into these states, the sense of self is getting diminished all the time. A very large part of the sense of self is all the verbalization, all the thinking. This is what the self loves to do. It loves to verbalize and think, right? And so you start to notice that actually my sense of ego, my sense of self is dying down. And then you start to see how delightful that actually is, yeah? And then you start to understand that the sense of self is a nuisance, yeah? The less there is of it, the better you feel. Get it out of the way, right? You kind of really get excited about that. So that is where we're starting to see the second aspect of emptiness. One is the emptiness in perception kind of calming down. The other one is where the sense of self starts to die away. And the ultimate emptiness here is when you see that all phenomena are empty of a self. There is actually just an illusion all the time. And once it is gone, that is when you see the full emptiness. So it is gradual, and there's also a point when you see it completely. There's like the path is both gradual and sudden. This is one of those kind of one of the classical discussions in Buddhism. Is the path gradual, sudden? Actually, it is both. You gradually go to a certain point, and then suddenly you have a breakthrough, an insight. Yes, please. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Be very happy to do that. Yeah. Yeah. We are running out of time. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. 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 You are right. We are running out of time. So maybe let's stop the questions there. Yeah. And then we just summarize just a little bit, and then we can do the five precepts for those who want, and then we can just say goodbye, I suppose. Yeah. As the very last thing. So just. I just want to summarize this very, very briefly, because one of the things about being on the retreat like this, there's a vast amount of information, and I don't know if you feel kind of overloaded after all of this, and you wonder, well, what should we focus on? What actually is really important in all of this? So the thing is that the only thing that you really need to remember of all of this, and the one thing that you really need to kind of, which at the core, at the base of everything in this path, is obviously kindness. I've been saying this all the time, yeah? This is the foundation for everything else. And if you make that your mainstay on the Buddhist path, and you remember this at all times, in your actions, in your speech, in your mind itself, right? So it actually permeates all aspects of your life, how you perceive other people, everything you do. That is really what you should focus on. And then when you come on a meditation retreat, you will start to see it starts to bear fruits, because you come in and you already have a really good feeling about yourself. You come in, you're able to bring up some joy because you're living a good life. It starts to come together very powerfully. So then usually at this point, then I ask people, are you able to remember that one teaching? Yeah. And people often say yes, but I say, no, you're not able to remember that one teaching. Yeah. If you were able to remember that one teaching, you would always be kind, right? So the thing is that in daily life, the reality is that we forget. We lose our inspiration, we get sidetracked by various kind of things. The defilements take over the mind and they lead you astray in the wrong direction. And even though you want to be kind, sometimes you just can't be kind. The habits and the defilements of the mind are so strong that basically they lead you astray. So the most important thing to help you with kindness, is to come back to these teachings. Come back to the ideas of the Buddha. Come back to the idea of right view. Because it is right view that ultimately helps you to be kind. Because if you understand the significance of kindness, if you understand how it is the foundation for all happiness on the path, if it is the foundation for everything else that you can ever achieve on the path, once you get that, once that is firmly lodged in your mind, that is where this whole thing becomes possible. And for that to be lodged in your mind, you need to be reminded. You need to recommit. You need to persevere. And that happens by hearing these teachings. Yeah, this is where you get inspired. So come back to these teachings. Listen to good Dhamma talks that actually inspire you in the right way. Listen to people who explain the suttas in a way that you can relate to. Read them for yourself when you feel inspired by these things, and gradually allow yourself to be brainwashed. Yeah. Now, of course, we think that brainwashing is bad, but brainwashing is a given in human life. We are all brainwashed. That's why marketing works. If brainwashing didn't work, marketing wouldn't work, right? So we know that brainwashing works. And so you're going to be brainwashed, so just choose the right kind of brainwashing. That's really the only thing you can do. You're going to be brainwashed regardless. So this is what this is about. So come back to these teachings. Allow them to kind of guide you in the right way. Yeah, build up that idea of right view, seeing things in the right way. And as you do that, then gradually it will lodge in the back of your mind. It will be there as a guidance at all times. Yeah, and then you will be heading in the right direction. And next time I see you here, is that right? Maybe I will see you here again in the future, maybe. Then hopefully you will be able to, your meditation will be more profound, yeah, more deep, more happy, more peaceful, and all these kind of things. And that's what you should look out for over time. Is the path working or not? And the way you know that is that when you come back to the meditation practice, you try it out again, something has happened. The mindfulness is more powerful. Your ability to stay with the breath is greater than it was before, right? That is how you know you're making progress. And the Buddha said we should evaluate our progress in this way. Otherwise, you have no idea whether it's working or not. And then you can adjust things as you go along. So there you are. There was one tiny little sutta at the very end, but I won't even read that. Let me read it out, because it's kind of a nice little sutta. It's called the Sutta at the Gautamaka Shrine. And at one time, the Buddha was staying near Vesali at the Gautamaka Tree Shrine. There the Buddha addressed the mendicants. Mendicants, venerable sir, they replied, and the Buddha said this. Mendicants, I teach based on direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge. I teach with reasons, not without them. I teach with a demonstrable basis, not without it. Since this is so, you should follow my advice and instruction. This is enough for you to be joyful, delighted, and happy. The Blessed One is fully awakened. The teaching is well explained. The Sangha is practicing well. That is what the Buddha said. Satisfied, the mendicants were happy with what the Buddha said. And while this discourse was being spoken, the galaxy shook. Well, the galaxy was getting a bit, whoa, this is powerful stuff, right? So that is the Buddha inspiring his monks, telling them that I'm coming from direct experience. I know what I'm talking about. This is the reality. I have seen the reality as it is. If you want to be happy, if you want to overcome suffering, listen, I'm doing this for your benefit, out of compassion for you. This is what it's saying. It's very powerful. And remember that the Buddha is only doing this for our benefit, out of compassion for us. That is why these teachings are there. This is the teacher who has discovered the highest happiness in the world, the ending of all suffering. This is the teacher that you have. Isn't that kind of amazing? Feel inspired by that and practice accordingly. And then, of course, you're going to have great benefits as a consequence. So, there you are. So, maybe now is a good time to take the five precepts. It's entirely up to you whether you want to take them or not. It's not really necessary to take them as such, but sometimes it can be like an additional commitment if you wish. So I will help you through this short little ceremony of taking the five precepts. Right? So the way this works is that it's called the three, taking the three refuges and the five precepts. And I will speak first, and then you follow after me. Right? As simple as that. And I will start by saying, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Do you know that one already? Yeah? Good. So I will say this first, then you say it afterwards. So, and then I will say, after that, I will say the three refuges, and one by one, then you can follow along, and then I will do the five precepts afterwards. If you don't want to take part in this, perfectly okay, don't have to. If there's one precept you don't want to keep, just kind of put your fingers, cross your fingers at the behind your back. Okay, don't want to keep that one. This is kind of an old trick done in some certain places around the world. I'm not going to say where, but done in certain places around the world. So here we go. So I go first, you go afterwards. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Buddhang saranang gacchami. Dhammang saranang gacchami. Sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. So that's the three refuges, and now we go on to the five precepts. Panatipata viramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Well done, that's very good. Excellent. Adinnadana viramani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Kame sumi chachara viratmani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Musavada viratmani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Okay, I'm going to go slowly with this one. Sura. Meraya, Majja, Pamada, Tana, Viratmani sikkhapadang samadhiyami. Em mani pancha sikapadani silena sugateng yanti silena boga sampada silena nibbuteng yanti tasma silang viso da ye. Which means that if you practice sila, then that leads to, first of all, it leads to happiness in this life. It leads to spiritual wealth, and ultimately it leads to nibbana, and that's why you should practice sila. Okay, well done everyone, that's wonderful. It's nice to see people keeping the five precepts. That's kind of a great starter. So I wish you all well. I wish you the great luck and benefit of all these wonderful teachings and the Dhamma, and the very best wishes for you for your practice. That's it for this retreat. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, just do the Arahant Samma Sambuddha one last time. I'm not going to put it on the screen, but we'll just see what happens without screening it. Are these a gift for me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. I will accept that. Okay, thanks. Put them over there. Okay, so let's...
Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasango Sangang Namami.
Come with you again. After the lunch, if you want to have a chat, I'm going to have a chat with you.
Sure.
I'll be in the interview room, so I'll meet you there. What time are you finished for lunch?
12:30.
12:30? I'll see you there at 12:30.
I'll finish earlier
than that. Yeah, okay. I'll probably be there at 12:30 then. And if you want to have a quick chat about whatever, we can kind of think that. So, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah.
Thank you, Arjun, for the teaching.
Yes, excellent. Thank you. Very good. Yeah, it's very nice to meet you all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.